For the last month, we've been doing a sermon series on hope. We've been calling it Hope is Born. We often talk about Christ came as the hope of the world. But I was thinking here, if we're saying that, what is it a hope from? Jesus a hope from, and what is it a hope towards? So we've been talking about some difficult things through December. We've talked about the problem of meaninglessness, about how a lot of people are searching to find a purpose for their lives, and how there's kind of a God-sized hole inside of them that can only be filled by the presence of God. And we've talked about broken relationships and how our message of hope is one of forgiveness and reconciliation and the chance to start anew. Last week we talked about sorrow and loss and about the difficulty we have when we lose that which is so precious to us, especially our loved ones, and about how there's a hope that we have in Jesus Christ. And today we're talking about suffering and why bad things happen to good people. Boy, it sounds like we've had a really depressing Christmas time here, hasn't it? But hopefully we don't end with that word of difficulty, but we end instead with that word of hope and grace. That's what I'm hoping you're here today. We're going to be looking today at the book of Job, which means in this one month, we have had the trifecta of depressing books of the Bible. We've had Ecclesiastes, Lamentations, and Job. Wow. I would not recommend sitting down and reading them all at one pop, right? That would be a really downer. The book of Job is indeed a very depressing book. We were doing in our study, I wrote this kind of summary, and I thought, boy, I did a pretty good job on this. What is it about? Well, in the Old Testament, there's this idea that we reap what we sow. And we believe that's true too, right? In fact, we tell our children when we're raising them, you know, don't do it this or this will happen, right? We believe that what we do produces what we get. But we also know that it isn't always true. And we can also be thankful for that. We recognize that sometimes the wicked prosper and that the good people sometimes suffer. What happens when bad things happen to good people? Well, questions arise. And the book of Job is a part of the wisdom literature of the Bible that attempts to deal with those questions. It tells us the story of Job, a good man who loses everything he loves and cares about. His wife, his children, his wealth, and his health all disappear in a heartbeat. Why did this happen? Where is God in the midst of all this loss and suffering? How does Job go forward into the future? The book of Job starts with, you know, Job sitting on this ash heap, and he's covered with boils, and he's just miserable. And he has these three friends that come and sit with him. And they sit with him for 3 days and say nothing, right? Which is not a bad model to follow. I don't know if you've ever been with somebody who's gone through a tough loss. There isn't much we can say, but our presence can make a difference. But they sit with him for 3 days, and theologians often say the problems begin when they start talking. Because when they start talking, they have this theology that says, well, you get what you deserve, so you must have done something, Job, to create this problem. So there's this long series, and I mean it is long. It is like 40 chapters long of them saying, you must have done something, and Job saying, I didn't do anything to deserve this. He says, I'm not perfect, but I didn't do anything of this magnitude to deserve the loss that I've received. And he says, I just want God to encounter me. I just want to meet God so I can ask him, so I can, you know, encounter him and learn some answers to my questions. And at the end of the book, God does indeed appear to him. And he says, why did this happen, basically? And God says, you don't get to find the answer here now, but I'm here to talk with you. I'm here with you. Well, that's an Old Testament answer to this, right? And in a lot of ways, it's unsatisfying. In a lot of ways, it's difficult. We'll talk more about that in a bit. But I want to bring up one thing that's kind of amazing about this book, and it is this, that in the midst of all this turmoil and all this difficulty, there is suddenly a word of hope, right? And we talked about this last time when we looked at Lamentations, that book. You know, there's all this mourning and terrible things that happen, and suddenly, again, a word of hope. But I told you, when I'm around people who are grieving, one of the amazing things to me is that's exactly what they do. They'll talk about how upset they are, how they've had a loss, how they question if God exists, and the very next minute, they'll start talking about how God is their support, their strength, the one who gets them through. And you could argue that that's kind of schizophrenic or it doesn't make sense, but I'm telling you it's the very human thing that we all do. Because in the midst of our doubts, there's still faith, and there's still hope, and there's still a future. And so we cling to our faith in times of difficulty and loss. And the story of Job is really about that. In the midst of that, we get those very hopeful verses that Dick read, and I want us to just go through them a little bit to see what they had to say. By the way, these are Job's three friends pointing at him and going, "It's your fault." Don't you like that? Huh? I saw that real picture, too, when I was in high school. It's William Blake, so it's one of my favorites. Anyhow, it starts off with these. "Oh, that my words were written down. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book." Now, I don't think I've ever said that. We'll talk more about the things you might want to have written down later on. So maybe it's something, if you were, I'll put on your thinking cap now, later on I might ask you, what if you were going to have one thing that was recorded for eternity, what would it be? But he's really saying here, this is a time when people didn't have access to paper, when those things were very expensive, when people hardly ever wrote anything down. He says, "Oh, that my words were written down." In other words, I want these saved, because nobody's going to believe that I said this now. You ever had something like that happen? You make a prophecy or a prediction, or you say something's going to happen, you know nobody's going to believe it later on, right? So that's what he's saying. "I want my words written down, so that they were inscribed in a book." So cut down, cut in, etched in. And then he says, "Oh, that with an iron pen and with lead they were engraved on a rock forever." I want these words to last because they're true. And they're so true that I'm betting, staking my life, my very self on them. You know, what are these words then that mean so much to him? And this is what he says. "For I know that my Redeemer lives." Right? I know that there's a God who exists. And he doesn't just call him God. He calls him Redeemer. What does that word redeem mean? Well, redeem means literally to buy back. Okay? And the idea is that we're enslaved to things here in this world. But we have been bought back, bought at a price. So we might be enslaved to sin or to other difficulties. God will redeem us, will buy us back, will take us from the place of loss that we were in and bring us to a place of wholeness and healing. "I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth." So here is Job sitting on this ash heap, covered with boils, in physical pain, with all this loss. And at that moment, he affirms that there is a God who exists, and not just a God who exists, but a God who cares about him. And at the end of time, he will stand upon the earth, and this is what he will do. And he will restore me, he will redeem me. "And after my skin has been thus destroyed, then in my flesh I shall see God." This is, as far as we know, the very first place in the Old Testament, chronologically speaking, where we have a prophecy of resurrection, a belief that is stated very strongly that we will be born again, that we will rise again. All right? And that may surprise you. The Old Testament, most of the time, does not affirm a belief in the resurrection. All right? In fact, there's only about three or four different places where it does. And indeed, even by Jesus' day, while the majority of Jews believed in the resurrection by then, many did not. You know, you've heard the Sadducees, right, and the Pharisees. I often tell folks the Sadducees, even in Jesus' day, didn't believe in a resurrection. That's why they were so sad, you see. Right, so ringing with you? Okay. So he affirms in the midst of this difficult time that there is a God who loves him, who cares about him, and even though right now he can't see any justice, that ultimately justice will take place. That God will restore things to the way that they should be and the way they were meant to be. Okay? And I will see this. My flesh, I shall see God. And you almost imagine him then at that point pointing to this rock that has it engraved on it. "I know that my Redeemer lives," and there is that truth. Now, it's kind of ironic that he says, "I wish I had this written down," because, of course, it is written down in our Bibles. We have this word of prophecy, and it struck so many people that we have lots of hymns that sing these words. "I know that my Redeemer lives." We talked about singing it today, but hey, it's Christmas Eve, right? We should sing something Christmassy and uplifting that way. But we know that our Redeemer lives and that we shall see him at the end of time. "Whom I shall see on my side, and my eyes shall behold and not another." What he means is, I'm going to get to see it. I'm the one that will. And I'll be there, and I'll know that what I've believed is true. And he says, "That's so glorious, my heart faints within me." It's almost stunning to me to think of this. And you imagine him going through this difficult, difficult time, and yet somehow there's this incredible word of hope that springs forth from him. Well, I want to lift up a few things about this. First is about judgment, and I don't know if you see this. It says, "Judgment day is coming, look busy." You know, I don't know if you've seen that before, but anyhow. I had a friend that had a bumper sticker that said that. And Jesus is coming, look busy, you know. Well, of course, we don't want to look busy. We want to actually live a life that is worthy of God and worthy of the kingdom. And we realize we're always going to fall short, so we trust in the grace of God. But my real statement here for you to think about is, how do you feel about judgment? You know, that's not something we talk a lot about today in our society. And interestingly enough, when you read through the Bible, there's different words on judgment in the scriptures. Judgment is always affirmed because, of course, we have a God who establishes right and wrong. And we recognize that here on this earth, not everything happens fully, completely, justly. And so we look to a time when God will restore justice, will make things right in every way. We look forward to a time when our tears will be wiped away, when healing will take place, when relationships will be restored. But we also recognize, as the Bible does, that not only will that be a beautiful day in many ways, but also a hard day in some ways, because we'll hear God's word of judgment that might be negative. So the Bible, there's a lot of people looking forward to Judgment Day, especially people who have been hurt or oppressed or damaged in some way. But there's a lot of word that says, you know, be careful what you wish for, because we have a just God who will look at our lives. And in the New Testament, we talk about the forgiveness and grace and how we live in that and how that makes all the difference. We'll talk more about that at the very end of the sermon today. But we look forward to not what based on what we have done, but what God has done for us. I'll tell you, to me, the great hope of a judgment is this. It means that God cares about enough about my life to actually value it and look at it. If I'm hearing God doesn't care of what I did or what I do, if it didn't matter to him, if he doesn't judge it ever, it's kind of like taking a class. I don't know if you've ever done this. Taking a class where you never get any feedback at all from the teacher. How much do you like that class? And how hard do you work? If they tell you in advance, I'm never going to look at your homework. I'm never going to grade it. I'm never going to evaluate it. I'm never going to give you any input. I'm just going to stand up here and talk, and you do your own thing. How much are you excited about that class? Are you going to show up? I don't know, right? We want an evaluator. We want to know how we're doing, right? We want to have the test. It's kind of like I heard about a fireman once in someplace in New York who freakily had gone his entire career and never fought a fire. I don't think I'd like that, right? I mean, in some ways it might be nice not to ever have to deal with that, but you want to spend your whole career preparing for something that you never got to do? Every time they had a fire, it was his day off, right? Just in his whole career, he managed to miss it. I think that would be bad. You'd want to have some chance to do it and see how you did, right? That's, to me, what judgment is about. God will look at it, and hopefully he'll say, first of all, you're forgiven, and second of all, well done, thou good and faithful servant. I mean, that's the message we'd like to hear, right? Well, judgment. But the big thing I wanted to talk about today is just this whole idea of suffering. I think it's an important issue for us to think about and to see what the scriptures have to tell us about this issue. First of all, we recognize there's a problem with suffering, but unlike some religions, like Buddhism, for instance, we don't think suffering is the number one problem in the world. Buddhism says that's the biggest problem we've got. What does Christianity say the biggest problem is? We're asking you. Sin. That's right. Sin is the biggest problem, and sin brings suffering with it and lots of difficulties, but our estrangement from God, you know, we do things that are in disobedience to God, so we're not in good relationship with God and others, and that causes a lot of the suffering in the world. So suffering is seen as more of a symptom than it is the major problem in the world. And we also say in Christianity that, you know, in some ways, pain is a good thing. And this is true, too. We recognize this more and more today. I several times in my ministry worked with people in the church who didn't feel physical pain. You know, maybe it was through some nerve damage or through diabetes or some other problem. I even knew one person with a psychological disorder that caused them not to feel any pain. Is that a good thing? No. You can't believe the problems that happen to people who don't feel pain because they can damage their body and not know what's happened. You know, so pain alerts us to things we need to take care of. What about emotional pain? You know, the biggest problem, pain that most people experience in their life is grief. You know, I read a sci-fi story where once there was this woman who was grieving her husband's death, and there were these aliens, you know, sci-fi, these aliens come by and they say, oh, we've sensed your pain, would you like us to take it away? And so they just come and take away all her pain because she says yes at that moment. And I thought, wow, if aliens came and offered me that in a time of grief, would I take it? I would hope not, right? don't you kind of want to have that kind of pain? Don't you want to miss people? Isn't that a part of being human and being in relationship with others? Okay, we recognize there's a place for pain in our lives. But there is a problem to suffering, you know? When we talk about this, and we ask, how can a God who is good and all-powerful allow suffering? And I would tell you that that question is never fully answered in Christianity or in the Bible. The Bible does give lots of partial answers to that question, but I don't think it's ever fully answered. Partially answered, well, a lot of our suffering is self-initiated, right? We do things that cause us to suffer. You know, I tell this story. My wife, Joy's a nurse, and one time she was taking care of a fellow who had been involved in a robbery and taken hostages. And in the course of this, he got shot about 5 times, and she's taking care of him in the hospital. And he asked her this question, why did this happen to me? Complete mystery, right? But we know a lot of times we are self-inflicting damage to ourselves. We do things that cause us harm. In fact, probably most of the biggest problems that we know people are experiencing are through things they have done to themselves. We also know that we suffer because we live in a fallen world. You know, even if we're doing things that are right, there are lots of people in this world who are doing things that are bad and who are harming others. And that's related to another thing. We have human freedom. And part of freedom means we can choose things that are negative for us, right? Choose patterns that are harmful to us. All those are partial answers, you know, self-inflicted, fallen world, human choice, but they don't fully answer. And I think there are real mysteries that we will never have answered during this lifetime. I mean, my brain's this big, right? And the universe is bigger by far, it's infinite, and God's even bigger than the universe. So how can I possibly know all the mysteries of life? There are things that I don't understand, and I think even trying to understand everything is in some ways a fool's errand. There will be things that I will not know. Soren Kierkegaard put it this way, you know, a thinker and theologian. He said, a thinker without a paradox is like a lover without passion, a paltry mediocrity. Another thing, suffering is so subjective, right? What causes me a lot of pain might be something that you could almost ignore. Again, Joy's a nurse. You know, she's always coming home and she says, I ask people every day, what is your pain level? 1 to 10. And you know what the number one answer she gets is? 10. Right? 10. And I was thinking, when she says that, we all go, huh, have I ever been at a 10? In pain-wise, you know? Been 10 good-looking? No. pain-wise. I don't think I ever have. Maybe when I've had a car door slammed on me briefly. Right? That would be the only time I could say. But a 10, that's a lot of pain. We feel and experience things differently. And spiritually, sometimes people go through a great trauma and it just they seem to sail through it, and other people will have something small and it seems to devastate them. Right? With lots of questions. Philip Yancey, a Christian writer and theologian, was writing a book on Job, and he called it Disappointment with God. That's a pretty challenging title, isn't it? And he set out to find the most Job-like person he could identify. So he had people, other people, looking for him, and he finally found a guy who was the most Job-like person he could encounter, right? And he goes to interview him, and he asks him this question, tell me about your disappointment with God. So this guy's lost his family, lost his health, lost everything, his business, you know, and this is the answer the man gives. He says, disappointed with God? I'm not disappointed with God. He's the only one that's got me through, you know? You see how what I mean? We experience pain in different ways and to different degrees, and it's kind of hard to gauge that, isn't it? Life requires a certain amount of toughness. Faith requires a certain kind of toughness. I remember when my kids were little, we were taking them in for shots. I can't remember why. And there was another family ahead of us getting shots also, why we were in this, you know, able to see them. But these kids were just screaming their heads off and, you know, fighting, didn't want to get the shots. And I was looking at my kids and I pulled them aside and I said, listen, they're going to give you shots. I'm not going to lie to you. It's going to hurt. Suck it up. Right? I don't know if they remember this. Joy is remembering this, right? Do you remember? I said, suck it up, you know? There's going to be things we need to do, and this is one of the things we need to do, right? And, you know, they were up there, and I remember Amanda especially, she got the shot, and she just went, that didn't really hurt at all. And she was kind of proud, you know, because there were all these wimps there. I mean, we've been there, right? There are things that hurt in this life, and, you know, are that can be what shapes our decisions and how we go forward. I once gave a bone marrow, and not only did I give the bone marrow, but then when I was there in the hospital, they for some reason, you know, they take blood out to give you later on, and they hadn't done that. So I got up to use the restroom, and I passed out. And there was a nurse about 90 pounds that came there and said, well, let me help you get up. And I said, you can't help me get up. She said, oh, yes, I can. I said, well, I don't think so. She says, come on. And she pulls me up about halfway. I pass out again. Wham! So I wake up, and you know, I'm kind of sore because I was unconscious a couple times. And from the whole thing that they did, my whole back turned black and blue. You know, so I look, Joyce said, I look kind of like I had been in a car accident. And I was moving like, you know, Tim Conway in those old, you remember? It's just moving like that, literally. And then, you know, they called me up to see how I was doing, and I said, well, fine, you know. And they said, would you give bone marrow again? And I said, well, sure. I mean, it's just pain, right? We can work through pain. We're going to have pain in this life. But now I'm saying all this, full disclosure, I'm not one of those people that has ever sat on the ash heap covered with boils. And I don't want to minimize the reality that some people have been there, right? Where the pain has been overwhelming, where they're experiencing a decline in health that is debilitating, where they're seeing their options becoming increasingly limited and their mobility taken away, and they're going through difficult times, slowly dying. I understand that people go through this, and I'm a little afraid that maybe as a pastor I'm not the most empathetic or sympathetic person in the world there, right? So we recognize that we're going through different places in suffering and different realities for people. I also want to say suffering has some positive aspects to it, too, that we want to affirm. First of all, you know, when we suffer, it makes us appreciate health and life, right? There are opportunities we have. We want to make the most of what we still can have and what's still left to us. So I remember we had someone in our church, you know, once who was in very poor health, and they were dying. And one of the things they had to do was put on weight. So they went to try every, their favorite food was milkshakes. So they went to every milkshake place in the Treasure Valley to try to determine which had the best milkshakes. What a great attitude that is, you know, to make the most out of the opportunities you have. It also, in some ways, toughens us in a way that is positive. That is, we often say the best steel goes through the fire. It's tempered. When we go through difficult times, it often teaches us that to rely on God, teaches us to rely on what's truly important and valuable. And a little statement on this is from a pastor in California. He says, it's a weak faith that only serves God in times of blessing. The book of Job teaches us that true faith, genuine faith, great faith is revealed only when we serve and trust God in the hard times, the times of suffering, loss, and opposition. That's the kind of faith that makes the world sit up and take notice. And I'll say this, suffering also can get people ready for death, for themselves, but also for others. You know, so many times I hear people say, when I go, I want to die in my sleep, right? You know, there's an old joke about that where the guy says, you know, when I die, I want to die like my father did, you know, in his sleep, not screaming like the passengers in his car, right? Don't want to go there, right? But have you ever been around somebody who does die suddenly? It's a shock for their family. It really is. And there's something, you know, to be said for having a time where you know it's going to come and you're getting ready for it and you're going to have an opportunity to settle things and to make things right and to share with others. And it also helps them to understand, hey, you know, my folks died. I got to say, they had gone through several years, both of them, of declining health to where we all saw it was a blessing. You know, it was. I don't mean to say we don't miss my parents, but, you know, in a sense, we could let them go very easily because we saw it was time, and indeed maybe past time for them to go. So that's just kind of a reality for a lot of us. It readies us. And, of course, I want to say this. The New Testament makes absolutely clear that suffering does not mean you are evil or being punished. That can happen. Right, we looked at the book of Lamentations last time, which was a book about people suffering because of things they had done. But we know that a lot of suffering just happens. It's a part of life, part of being in this fallen world. And indeed, it's a product of our faith. We do things as Christians that cause the world, which is in many ways evil, to attack us or be upset with us. Jesus really blows up that idea of all suffering comes to us because we deserve it, right? What's the message of the cross? That the good man, the best man, the only perfect man, the Son of God, God himself came to this earth and what? Tortured, mocked, and abused. And he didn't promise us as Christians that all those problems would go away. Instead, he promised the opposite. He said, if anyone would be my disciple, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and come follow me. For whoever loses his life for my sake in the gospel will find it. Right? That's a challenging word for us to hear. It doesn't mean that we'll never have suffering. It doesn't mean that we'll never have difficulties. But it does mean this, the fact that God experienced this on the cross tells us, first of all, that God understands. You know, years ago when I was in college, I went out to pull up. I was living with my oldest brother, and he lived in a nice neighborhood in Washington, D.C. And as I came out one day to take out our garbage can and put it on the side, I saw this woman across the way who was really struggling. She was in a wheelchair, and I didn't even... I think she just moved there. I didn't know she was there. So I went over and helped her with this and found out she had MS, and she had, as soon as she had, the disease had taken away her mobility, so she was in a wheelchair, her husband had left her and her son. So she was raising a five-year-old son in a house that could not have been more poorly designed for her need. Let's put it that way. And so we began as a family just to kind of volunteer to do stuff for her. But she was not a believer in any way, shape, or form, and she started asking me questions about this, you know, and I said, well, I don't know why this happened to you, but I do know that God understands. And she came to me later on, and she said, you know, you're so right. I'd never thought about this before, but, you know, God, Jesus on the cross, knew what it was like not to be able to move, just like I can't move, even worse, because I can move my arms, but he couldn't move anything. And I thought, wow, that's kind of a deep insight. You know, God understands our suffering and our pain. He knows what it's like to be rejected or go through really almost anything you want to think of. The message of the cross is that God understands and he cares, that he's there with us in times of difficulty. He didn't come to this earth to be lauded and glorified. He came to suffer, to let us know that he understands and that he's there beside us along the way. You know, that's powerful to know. And it also tells us that suffering can be redemptive. One of the things the Bible tells us that I have struggled with is why Jesus had to die in this way to bring us healing, to bring us wholeness, to bring us forgiveness. Yet the Bible not only affirms that, but it tells us that to some degree we can participate in that redemptive healing. That is to say, when we suffer, how we deal with it makes a difference in how the world is. We can be a blessing to others in the way that we take on suffering that comes our way. Suffering, also, just kind of one last word, and it ties right into what we're going to finish with here. Suffering is not eternal. That's good to know, isn't it? The book of Revelation that we're going to look at next Sunday tells us that in heaven, God will wipe away every tear, and that we will be restored and whole and joyous. Well, the last thing I wanted to bring up is the thing that I mentioned a while back. You know, Job says, I want to write this down. And so, what would you want to write down if you were writing down something for eternity? You know, that's the challenge I had for you. I asked the men's group this week, and they gave some good answers. One said, let love rule. Courtney, I said we'd quote him on this. I don't know if he's here right here in the sanctuary right now, but he said, give it a try. And we said, well, that's terrible advice. He said, no, no, what I meant was, study the word. Give faith a chance. Give faith a chance. And we thought, oh, okay, that's good. Okay. Someone said, continue to persevere. You know, stick with it. What would you have? Yeah. Love is the answer. Okay. Anybody else? Well, something to think about. This kind of brought me back to something they used to ask us years ago. People say, what would you want inscribed on your tombstone? You know, what message would you have? And one of my favorite stories is kind of related to this. I tell it a lot at funerals. Some of you, I'm sure, have probably heard it before, but when I was a kid, we lived right. My school was next to a cemetery, so we would play right next to the tombstones. There was a little fence in between us, which I thought was kind of cool. I thought it'd be neat to be buried there and get to watch all the kids play. Now that I'm older, it sounds kind of noisy. But anyhow, and I would work on a farm, and right next to us there was an old abandoned cemetery that people had just neglected, and they came to restore it. And that's what this story is about: an old cemetery in upstate New York that had been abandoned. All the tombstones had fallen down, things were overgrown, and they decided to go in there and clean it up. You know, one of these scout projects where they go in there and fix everything up as an Eagle kind of project, and they were restoring everything, and they're putting the tombstones back on. And they found one tombstone that was really different from all the others because it didn't have the usual stuff that tombstones always have. Because what do they have? You know, some word or phrase like rest in peace or something like that. Didn't have that. It didn't have the date of birth and the date of death. None of that. In fact, it didn't even have the guy's name. It had only one word. And to me, this is such a neat thing to have. I kind of want to do this myself. It had one word, and it was forgiven. And you think, wow, that's kind of cool. It's not about me. It's not about what I've done. It's not about how long I lived. It's really about Jesus and what he's done for me. Kind of a neat thing to have inscribed on stone, maybe there as a testimony to faith. But what a powerful word that is for us, forgiven. That's our hope, really, isn't it? Whatever suffering we endure here, however much we understand it or don't understand it, our hope is in a God who forgives, who restores, and at the end of time will be our Redeemer and a blessing to us. Let's just bow in prayer. Holy Spirit, we thank you for your grace that always surrounds us. We thank you that you came and cared enough to live here as one of us. You came not in power and strength, but in weakness and vulnerability. And in humility, you reached out to let us know that your grace is always there. Bless us, we pray, Lord, that we might know the fullness and power of your forgiveness. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.